This is February 6th, 2011. And this talk is going to be on the topic of anxiety. And I'm going to be reading from an article that two or three different people sent to me recently, entitled American Anxiety, The Three Real Reasons Why We Are More Stressed Than Ever Before. This was written by somebody named Taylor Clark and posted on Monday, January 31st, on Slate.com. It starts off like this. Why are college students so stressed? When a team of UCLA researchers released its latest annual report on the mindset of America's university students last week, one finding screamed out for red alert media attention. Our college kids are more stressed out and anxious than ever before. In the researchers' surveys of more than 200,000 incoming freshmen, students reported all-time lows in overall mental health and emotional stability, and this news sent the media on a high-strung spree of its own. ABC World News ran footage of harried-looking teenagers rushing around campus. Time wondered, why are college students reporting record high levels of stress? And the New York Times story on the report vaulted to the top of the paper's most emailed list. Let me go a little farther here before I comment. The culprit for this soaring stress, the stories unanimously declared, is the horrendous job market. A thoroughly lame explanation. I don't know about your college experience, but when I got to school a dozen years ago, my classmates spent about as much time pondering the future job market as they spent leafing through calculus textbooks for fun. These news stories have missed the truth because they've overlooked one crucial fact. Students are becoming more anxious because, for many years now, we've all been growing more anxious. This isn't just a campus issue, it's an American issue. It says, for over the last several decades, both through good economic times and bad, the United States has transformed into the planet's undisputed worry champion. We're number one. Around the turn of the millennium, anxiety flew past depression as the most prominent mental health issue in America, and it's never looked back. With more than 18% of adults suffering from an anxiety disorder in any given year, that's one in five for those of you who are mathematically challenged, the United States is now the most anxious nation in the world, according to the National Institute of Mental Health. Stress-related ailments cost the nation $300 billion every year in medical bills and lost productivity, while our usage of sedative drugs keeps skyrocketing. Just between 1997 and 2004, Americans more than doubled their spending on anti-anxiety medications like Xanax and Valium, from $900 million to $2.1 billion. I should point out that what he isn't telling you, of course, is that inflation has continued to run along during those years, and although we've doubled our spending, I doubt that we've come close to doubling our usage. This anxious strain hits us well before we reach college. As psychologist Robert Leahy points out, the average high school student today has the same level of anxiety as the average psychiatric patient in the early 1950s. Oh, to be a psychiatric patient in the 1950s. Okay. So there's something here. I have to say, I don't know if anxiety has truly grown as much as this article is saying, but it certainly is a huge factor. And, you know, I get a little taste of it in the Dyson room. It's always so difficult when someone comes in so anxious that they can't even hear what you're saying. And that does happen. You know, you just want to throw them on the floor and hug them or something. But it's anxiety has been part of the human condition forever, and it's been part of my life forever. You know, I've certainly it's nothing like it what it used to be, but you know, I came up anxious, no question about it, and there's one big thing to be anxious about, of course, and that's the fact that we're all going to die. Interestingly enough, this article that I'm going to look into talks about some of the reasons for anxiety and doesn't mention that one. I don't know. I'd give it some weight, I think. But we'll get into that in a minute. The trouble with taking this alarmist report of the surge of anxiety at face value, of course, is that this is all self-reported. And back in the 1950s, very likely, people were much less likely to identify themselves as anxious, although they may have been quite anxious. It's in the vernacular now. It's a way that we talk about ourselves and talk about our lives. And it doesn't matter. You know, is it going up? Is it going down? The fact of the matter, it's there, and we need to find a way to deal with it. And I would say, actually, let me read a little further into this, because he starts to make this point, and then I have something more to say about it. He says, this national surge in nerves is somewhat baffling because we're actually safer from true danger than we've ever been. Although I'd point out that mortality is still 100%. A century ago, psychologist William James wrote that modernity had insulated us so well from grave threats like grizzly bear attacks. Now it's just mama grizzlies you have to worry about. And tiger moms. That in civilized life, it has at last become possible for large numbers of people to pass from the cradle to the grave without ever having had a pang of genuine fear. And that does make a good distinction between anxiety and flat-out fear. You know, it's one thing to be held up at gunpoint or to be alone in the woods and come across a bear. That is different than the anxiety the anxieties that we suffer from, some of which are so-called free-floating anxiety. People don't even know what they're worried about. They just feel anxious. So we are less likely to run into the sort of life and death situations that William James was talking about. He says, James might have been surprised to learn that even as our streets become safer, our cars more crash-proof, and our food and drugs better regulated, it's debatable, we still keep finding ways to become more tense. I suspect that he wouldn't be that surprised. But anyway. He says, and don't assume that this is a problem that affects all nations equally. According to the 2002 World Mental Health Survey, people in developing world countries such as Nigeria are up to 5 times less likely to show clinically significant anxiety levels than Americans, despite having more basic life necessities to worry about. And I suspect even when we adjust for the fact that we have more anxiety is more in our vocabulary than it is in people in third world countries, developing countries, nevertheless, I do think there's way more anxiety here than there is there. My own experience was just a couple weeks I spent in Oaxaca. The two things, what really surprised me or struck me the most was how poor people were and how happy they were. It was just remarkable, you know, riding the bus and, you know, we're all packed on, and people are hanging off the sides. And, the vibes are good. And I think even in this country, one that we've had times where times are truly tough, you know, say during World War II, I think the national mood actually tends to improve, at least that's what I've read, and it makes sense. When you know what to worry about, then some of the small stuff just fades into the insignificance that it deserves. Okay, so now he's going to tell us what makes us anxious. He says, what's behind our ballooning issues with anxiety and stress? This is a thorny question, obviously, and one that can't be solved with any single answer. We could blame our cutthroat work environment, for example, yet work stress alone can't explain our fretfulness, since anxiety hits housewives and the idle rich just as hard. And it is terrible about the anxiety of the idle rich. We might point the finger at the sputtering economy, but we kept growing more anxious even in boom times. When I was researching my new book, and unfortunately I don't know the title of that, on how people deal best with fear, stress, and pressure, however, I spoke with scores of psychologists and neuroscientists about this question, and I picked up three main themes in their replies. Together, this trio of answers offers a solid start toward explaining the rise of our national nervousness. And I think these are all three really good things to look at, and good for those of us practicing Zen to look at. So let's take them one at a time. The first one is what he calls loss of community. He says, for the experts, one particularly egregious offender is America's increasing loss of community, what we might call the bowling alone effect. Bowling Alone was this book that came out, I don't know, 10 or 20 years ago, I imagine, that just documented the fact that Americans are far less likely to engage in organized social activity. We're less likely to join a bowling league and more likely to go bowl alone. And there's a lot less membership in Kiwanis and other, you know, organizations, service organizations, where people are rubbing shoulders with each other and having human contact. And instead, much more time is spent at home in front of the TV. And of course, when that book kind of came out, I don't think the internet had really gotten ramped up to full speed. But now you see people not only absorbed in the big screens, but walking around staring at their little iPods and iPhones. We're not going to talk about my habits here. But it is amazing. Chris and I were at Chautauqua last summer, and we were sitting in the audience for some concert, and any time there was a break or intermission, everybody in front of us had an iPhone, and they were either playing a game on it or doodling through their email, or I'm not sure what all they were doing. I felt quite superior to them at the time. But we're working on that. Okay. Chris gave me an iPod for my birthday, and it's now been dubbed the worst gift ever. Okay. He says, human contact and kinship help alleviate anxiety. Our evolutionary ancestors, of course, were always safer in numbers. Yet as we leave family behind to migrate all over the country, often settling in insular suburbs where our closest pal is our plasma screen TV, might update that to say LED screen, we miss out on all this important element of in-person connection. As fear researcher, great job, as fear researcher Michael Davis of Emory University told me, if you've lost the extended family and lost the sense of community, you're going to have fewer people you can depend on, and therefore you'll be more anxious. Other cultures have much more social support and are better off psychologically because of it. We have a friend, actually used to be Chris's business partner, who's going to be marrying a woman from Colombia. She has 127 cousins. It's just astounding. And I think she knows them all. But we don't have that. You know, it's so painful. Just the fact that, you know, typically your children don't live in the same town that you live in. I'm not sure why there isn't legislation about that. Says another factor that adds to this problem, especially among young people, is our growing reliance on texting and social media for community, which many psychologists say is no substitute for real human interaction. Duh. When you're feeling most dreadful, you don't run to your Facebook profile for consolation. You run to a flesh and blood friend. This is definitely, it's got to be having an effect. I'm not a teenager. I'm not a college student. And so I hesitate to say definitively that's a big part of their problem. But it is remarkable how much people text. Somebody was telling me that their son in 1 month made 8,000 text phone calls. He picked this up because he had yet to get an unlimited texting plan and he was paying for it. But that's just astounding. You know, that's just astounding. And Roshi says that Angela's reported to him that sometimes when teenagers are describing a conversation they've had with somebody, as they're talking, they're miming the texting that they were actually doing when they were having that conversation. So it's really, really ingrained. And it's just not enough. It's one of the real values that we can gain of becoming connected with other people who are practicing with us. It really does make a difference, time permitting and circumstances allowing it, to spend a little more time at the center. I think there's a great value in volunteering now and then and just rubbing shoulders with people who are doing the same thing that we're doing. You know, sometimes that's not possible and we have to, to a large extent, soldier on by ourselves. But if we have the opportunity, try it. Connecting with other people who are doing the same thing that you're doing can really make a big difference. The Buddha said, having excellent friends and keeping good company is not half the sacred way, it is the way itself. When we practice, we're going against the grain of society. We're swimming upstream. We're making this effort not to live on the surface, not to live in one thought, hopping to another, to another, to another, to another, trying to find a deeper level, and it's hard. And it helps to know there are other people in the same boat as we are. It occurred to me, it's a similar phenomenon to what's really, really significant in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a program for people who are in a whole lot of trouble, obviously. And one of the ways that it works is because you're spending time sharing on a fairly significant level with other people who are in the same boat. And we could all, of course, join Thinkers Anonymous. Seriously, the addiction to thought is stronger than the addiction to alcohol or drugs. And it's in the end, it's probably as destructive. But one of the difficulties that many people like me, cynical people, have is our tendency to turn our critical faculties outwards and see what's wrong with other people. It's harder to become intimate with others when we're focused on their shortcomings. And everybody that I've ever met has shortcomings. And yet everybody I've ever met is a Buddha. It's easy for me to say, but really, really worth making the effort to open up to other people in a non-judgmental way. There's that line that we recite in the repentance ceremony, to remember that everyone is a Dharma brother or sister, striving for self-completion. If we can find the generosity to give other people the benefit of the doubt, it actually has an effect on our relationship to ourselves. The people who are the most critical of others, the most judgmental, are also the people who are hardest on themselves, and as you find out in Zen practice, being hard on yourself in that way, in that judgmental way, is just a huge barrier to getting below the surface of the mind. Roshi Kaplow, early in his teaching career here in Rochester, maybe even before it began, was interviewed by the New York Times. He appeared in the New York Times magazine. And all I remember from that article is him saying something about the beauty of an angry face. That even in the face of someone who's angry, there's beauty if we can look. If we don't wall them off, and we can open up. Okay. He moves next to the topic of information overload. He says, continuing with this tech theme, the next culprit the experts mentioned was the torrent of often nerve-wracking information we now consume. For one thing, the amount of data we take in each day has jumped dramatically. The average Sunday newspaper contains more raw information than people in earlier eras would absorb over the course of a few years. Of course, that's assuming you read the whole paper, or that anybody reads the whole paper. And some neuroscientists believe that our brains simply weren't designed to handle this kind of volume. But even worse, this avalanche of data is increasingly of the alarmist, fear-igniting variety. And here I might add, like this whole story. It's, and you can understand why it's that way. I mean, everybody in the media, everybody writing a book, everybody trying to, you know, give a talk or get people's attention is competing with all the other voices out there. And how else do you get people's attention than scare the crap out of them? And so it's part of our consumerist society that naturally fear is the lead. You know, it's what people turn to, and so that's what's offered. It says if a TV newscast isn't covering a grisly double homicide, the anchor is teasing a story about the hidden threat in your own home. The media does this to us, explained Evelyn Bahar, a worry expert. Who teaches at the University of Illinois, Chicago. It's always reporting that this thing causes cancer or that thing can kill you. We live in a culture where fear is used to motivate us. That's absolutely true. I would actually put more stress on the triviality of the information than on the fact that it's often being negative. I think usually people are able to sort of sort through the negative stuff, and we're not truly terrified by the media's constant alarmist drumbeat, but I'm sure we're affected by it. But what's more sort of soul-draining is the superficial nature of what we're given. It's called surfing because you do it on the surface. Surfing is the opposite of diving. And this whole, I can speak from my own experience, the to get on the internet and hop from one thing to another, and to check your email, to look at the latest headlines, to see what the weather is. There's just so much trivial stuff out there that we can look at, and it's addictive. It's addictive in a really strange way, because it's not addictive in a euphoric way. I prefer addictive substances that get you high. At least that's what I always, in my earlier years, that's what I turned to. But this is an addiction that it just sort of keeps you numb, I think is the best that it can do. And in the end, it leaves you kind of empty. And I know it's a struggle for others. This in term intensives, this comes up very often. In fact, a lot of us, this particular term intensive, have made a commitment not to, at least on Sunday, not to get on the internet. In fact, one member has a no power Sunday, and he turns off everything, including electricity. I think he keeps the heat going. Years ago, Henry David Thoreau said, "The mind can be permanently profaned by the habit of attending to trivial things, so that all our thoughts shall be tinged with triviality." And he also said in another time, "We are in great haste to construct a magnetic telegraph." This is high tech of the 1800s. "A magnetic telegraph from Maine to Texas. But Maine and Texas, it may be, have nothing important to communicate." So, our the magnetic telegraph is now the internet. Maine and Texas are now China and Indonesia. But again, what is it that we're getting? What is it that's sustaining? You know, it's like the difference between eating nourishing food and eating Doritos. Doritos are really good. I know, I've eaten them. And they it's a cheap thrill, you know, there's something and when people get in the habit of eating Doritos and snack food and other kinds of crap, they aren't that interested in eating you know, lentils and sweet and sour lentils, or you know, fresh fruit, or all the other things that are good for you. So the same thing comes in our mental life. When so much of what we're doing is just short-term little, oh, look at this, oh, look at that. It doesn't leave room for sitting by the window and watching the snow come down. You know, all those things that there was more room for 40 or 50 years ago. If we want them now, we actually have to think about it. We actually have to plan for it. We actually have to think about, what do I value? A couple of days ago, I suddenly got sick, and at first it was kind of this pleasant dizziness, spinning around in my chair in my office, seeing if I could maybe aggravate a little bit, because it was kind of fun. And then I was on the floor, unable to really stand up, and then I was hugging a bucket. But what happened in that whole process, I finally, the last stage of my Stations of the Cross was after I'd been driven home in the living room of my own home, me and my bucket on the floor, not quite all the way upstairs, while the gut brain did what it needed to do. But what was really striking about it was how everything else fell away. There was actually something kind of wonderful about it. You know, I was just there, and there was the floor right in front of me, and some strange white bug crawling across it that was too small to even notice. And, you know, all the little things, got to check this, got to do that, got to pick this up, they all just sort of disappeared. And that was nice. That was really nice. Of course, ideally, that's what happens when we sit in Zazen. That's why it's so important to find a way not to be continually seduced by our habitual thoughts, not to be constantly standing outside or sitting and evaluating it. It's much easier said than done, but it can be done. It does happen if we work at it. But as long as we're sitting there tapping our foot, thinking, where are the results? Or even worse, if we're thinking, you know, well, I've been sitting for this long, and this person is here, and that person is there, and look at me, I'm nowhere. You know, if we're indulging in thoughts, we're tied to the dock. We're not going to set out to sea as long as we're stuck in evaluation. Here's a wonderful thing that someone said. David Levy, a professor at the information school at the University of Washington, said, "We need the equivalent of old growth forests and marshlands in our mental lives." And we have the way to get that. In fact, we have that from the beginning. The old growth forest is our true nature. It's here. We need to turn our head around. Okay, on to his third factor. He says, finally, we're especially vulnerable to this kind of manipulation, that is the fear manipulation he was talking about before, because of the third factor, our intolerant attitude toward negative feelings. Put simply, Americans have developed habits for dealing with anxiety and stress that actually make them far worse. We vilify our aversive emotions and fight them rather than letting them run their own course. We avoid situations that make us nervous. We try to bury uncomfortable feelings like anxiety and stress with alcohol or entertainment or shopping sprees. Psychologist Stephen Hayes, the creator of a highly effective anxiety treatment formula called Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, and coincidentally, this is a guy I read from and gave a Dharma talk on a year or two ago. Stephen Hayes told me that we've fallen victim to feel-goodism, the idea that bad feelings ought to be annihilated, controlled, or erased by a pill. This intolerance toward emotional pain puts us at loggerheads with the basic truth about being human. Sometimes we just feel bad, and there's nothing wrong with that, which is why struggling too hard to control our anxiety and stress only makes things more difficult. Okay, this is really the big one, and it's totally entwined with difficulty in Zen practice and naturally with difficulty in life. One way to come at it is just to say, why shouldn't the weather be miserable sometimes? Why shouldn't storms come through? Why shouldn't it be hot and humid? What's wrong with feeling bad? Socrates, of course, said, the unexamined life is not worth living. But if we're running away from these states, if the minute we feel it, twinge of anxiety, we want to find some way of burying it, whether it's surfing on the computer or having a drink or watching a movie, we're leaving something really significant unexamined. It's a huge pivot when we suddenly realize, oh, instead of walling myself off from what feels bad, I can turn and face it. And when I turn and face it, I can get to know it. And it's not my job to change it. In fact, when I truly let it in, then it moves through. You'll find that it moves through. But as long as you're trying to ease it out the door, you're actually holding on to it. It's so paradoxical. The more we try not to feel bad, the more we condemn ourselves to feeling shitty. That this half looking at bad feelings One of the things that will happen, and this used to happen to me all the time, is you'll suddenly notice that you feel bad and you can't remember why. I don't know if other people have had this experience. I'm going to bet a lot of people have. And what I used to do is then I would just sort of trace back through my thoughts and try to find where it was. And sometimes I would get back far enough to find it. And it was, you know, maybe some onerous job that I had to do that I was dreading, or somebody I had to talk to, or some painful thing. That thought came up. I just went, oh, and I moved on. And then all that was left was feeling crappy because I didn't deal with it. You know, the Buddha said, if you have some fear of some pain or suffering, you should examine whether there is anything you can do about it. If you can, excuse me, it's not the Buddha, we're the Dalai Lama, close enough. If you can, there is no need to worry about it. If you cannot do anything, then there is also no need to worry. Here's something else sort of to the point. This is from Eiken Roshi. He has a quote about two ways of doing sesshin. He says, there are two ways to get through a sesshin. One is to concentrate on survival, and the second is to focus on each moment as it comes up. Either way will get you through the sesshin. But only the second way will give you an effective sesshin, whatever he means by effective. If you focus on survival, then you will be disappointed after your sesshin because you will know that you have wasted your time just thinking about getting through it. Forget about getting through it. Just focus on that one, on that two, on that three. That's all. Nothing else. Everything opens up when we stop worrying needlessly and find our home in the present moment. It's so painful to see someone trying to work their way out of pain through their thoughts. It's like a fish flopping in a boat. Right in this moment, if we can just let it all in, let the painful stuff in as well, right in this moment, there's healing. And we, obviously, you know, people talk about being in the present, being in the now all the time. It's you can't just talk about it and then do it. You need a practice. You need a way of learning how to do it. You need a way of coming to trust in the process. And that's what Zazen is. That's what mindfulness throughout the day is. Just coming back, having faith, realizing that we're not in control of the process. These aren't problems for us to take the crude hammer of our thinking intellect and bludgeon into submission. This is something we have to feel our way into. We need to learn how to be alive. We need to learn to be at home with what is. Byron Katie, this strange and interesting woman from California. Roshi gave a teisho on her once. Is fond of saying when you struggle with what is, you're struggling with reality. How can you possibly win? It's there's so much that we can learn when we start looking directly. With anxiety in particular, you know, where do we feel it? Where in our body is that anxious sensation? You know, is it in the pit of the stomach? Is it in the chest? You know, tension in the shoulders. There's a lot of information there that we may not be really taking in. And that sort of stuff then gets into the unconscious. It's unconscious baggage that we carry with us all the time. To be able to really open up to it is to let it shift, let it change. Of course, the key thing is we have to have the equanimity to accept things as they are. The second patriarch, Zhongzhe Songsan, in the verses of the Faith Mind, which we recite, says, "The great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. When preferences are cast aside, the way stands clear and undisguised." He's giving you everything. That's it. That's totally it. There was a spiritual teacher named Krishnamurti who wrote a lot of books and used to use the phrase choiceless awareness. Because when you have a preference, when you indulge it, when you cling to it, then you're closed off. It's mechanical. It's simple. It's just like billiard balls hitting each other. As long as you want a result, you're preventing things from moving. And when you can embrace the present as it is, you know, crummy day, good day, whatever, then everything moves. Everything can flow. It can feel hard to keep doing this, to keep opening up, to keep dropping thoughts, to keep returning to the present, returning to the practice, returning to the koan. But the difficulty of maintaining that effort really comes more from our preoccupation with results, with our casting our minds into the future and wondering, you know, is anything going to happen? Can I keep this up? Then from the effort itself. The effort itself is actually sustaining. It's great to get a taste for practice, to feel at home in the effort. Zen Master Dogen said, "This effort is not thing. It's not something that people of this world naturally like, but it's the final refuge of all." So when we open up to this moment, then time pressure, triviality, all these assaults disappear. Which is ironic because we're looking past this moment because we think it's unimportant, because we have these worries that we think we need to attend to. And yet, it's the only thing that's real. So our time is about up. I'll stop here, and if anybody has comments or questions, yeah, Dwayne.
I had a very interesting lesson one time in how distancing oneself from difficulties actually increases the difficulties. I worked in a heart attack research unit, and we were shown a film of open heart surgery. It was so striking I could hardly keep my lunch down. And then a couple of months later, I was actually in the operating room. And the doctor was operating on the heart, and he says, "Oh, Dwayne, let me show you the left anterior descending, you know," and he picks the heart up out of the chest and turns it a little bit, you know. And I say, "Ah, that's what it looks like." Being in the moment was so much easier than watching it on a screen.
Sort of wanting everything in trivial little bites. One thing I found at one point that is another problem that causes is it was I was starting I noticed I was starting to have problems really focusing on reading like a long substantive book, and I was wondering, well, this never used to be a problem at all, and I realized it was because so much of my attention was becoming habituated to just like little 30-second chunks of stuff.
Yeah, that's actually, I came across people who mentioned that as a phenomenon in some of the other articles that I looked at, and I've noticed it myself. Yeah, I used to read in depth more, and now there is a tendency to dip in for a while and all of a sudden, you know, go off and do something different. I think it's worth making the effort. You know, it's that thing about nourishing food. I think it is better to dive deeply into, you know, one book or even one movie or whatever, not to spend so much time, you know, skimming.
John?
Yeah.
Yeah. During your talk, it occurred to me that grocery shopping used to be enjoyable for me. I used to look forward to it, and the last few years it's become more anxiety provoking. The decisions, because of all the information, is it in plastic? I may have BPA. Is it local? Is the packaging recyclable? Is it organic? Does it have partially hydrogenated oils? Does it have MSG or hydrolyzed yeast extract or hydrolyzed protein? You know, does it have? You know, but I can go on. I used to enjoy grocery shopping, but yeah, I guess all the triviality has gotten in the way, and so that I'm going to try to let go of some of those concerns because, you know,
Yeah, there's so many things that you can focus on, you know, and sometimes one thing sort of becomes the gauge by which you judge everything. So I think, you know, like with purity of food or, you know, there's so many other things, it can just become too big a deal. And sometimes you just have to say, you know what, I'm going to do a good enough job and not do a perfect job. And it's good to stop and think, wait a minute, what's really important? You know, maybe what's really important is, you know, conversations with people that I love or, you know, offering support to the people that I can help or getting on the mat. But we chase down all kinds of rabbit holes. Yeah, Matt.
Just quickly, I remember talking to a therapist who said, in terms of anxiety, one of the first things he asks when a patient comes in complaining of anxiety, which we don't often think about, is, you know, how many stimulants we're taking.
Oh, yeah.
Our addiction to coffee over these last number of years become unbelievable. Crap of mappuccinos that are like 32 ounces and stuff. I mean, I imagine that plays a big role in people's anxiety levels.
I've seen that happen, yeah, on the New Jersey Turnpike.
I can't resist letting people know about one of the lawyers I worked with in Washington who actually thought he was having neurological or psychiatric problems. His hands were trembling. And among other things. And he went to the doctor, and it turned out it was the 15 to 20 cups of coffee a day that he was doing.
Wow. I bow down to that man. Well, what's really scary now is they have alcoholic drinks with caffeine in them. Mm. Yeah, to keep you from falling asleep so you can keep drinking. Well, I think we're probably have used up all our time, so let's finish with the four vows.